Hello, everybody. Welcome to another Science Studio program. My name is Keith Pannell. I'm here again with Russ Chianelli. And today we have a very special guest. All our guests are very special. But in this particular case, we're going to be talking to one of the rare breed of scientists who's been recognized being the recipient of a Nobel Prize in physics. So, Russ, who is our guest today?
We're very happy to welcome to Science Studio Dr. Douglas Osheroff. And he's professor of physics at Stanford University and our guest here on Science Studio. Welcome to Science Studio, Doug.
Thank you.
Well, it's great to have you here. And before we get into all that wonderful work that you did those years ago to garner the Nobel Prize and such great recognition, let's find out, how did you get into science? It's a question that we always like to find out. There have got to be some stimulations that put you into this at very early age.
Curiosity, I suppose. I think I was 6 years old when I got an electric train set for Christmas, and I think my father would take a nap between 1 and 2 every afternoon, and when he woke up from his nap, he found that the locomotive had been taken apart. And I suppose that this was one of these watershed moments in life. If he had said, "You destructive devil, you, go to bed without your supper," we probably wouldn't be having this conversation now. But he, I think, looked at this and recognized my fascination with electricity and magnetism. And almost immediately we started doing experiments together in the basement.
Did he put it back together?
I don't think that was. I think he appreciated that it was important that I put it back together.
Then that never happened.
I think it did.
When you were 18 or what?
No.
Straight away at six?
I was pretty good.
Wow.
Yeah.
Did you unwind the copper wires on the motor?
Well, no. I just took the motor out. I was interested in playing with a motor. So it was a matter of just getting the motor geared in properly.
Right. Well, the trouble with electricity, of course, I mean, is the fact you can shock yourself. I mean,
I've done that many, many, many times.
When was the first time? I mean, it must have been post 6 years old, seven?
I suppose it was in fourth grade when I was given a bunch of junk from the telephone company, and in there were some paper capacitors and some relays. So there was one that was a solenoid actuated relay. And I connected this, and 22.5-volt battery. That's what the phone company ran on at that point. And so I connected the relay to the solenoid in the relay to the battery. And when I removed the leads, I got shocked. I asked my father, and he says, "Well, so the electric field collapses very quickly, and a changing magnetic field collapses quickly, and a changing magnetic field generates an electric field." And I didn't understand that exactly. But
you knew you'd been shocked.
So I packaged this thing in a duffel bag and brought it to school. And so the only thing that was extending out was the end of a lamp cord. And the part that you plug in the wall, if you squeeze those two prongs together, when you release them, you got shocked. And kids were lined up 20 deep to be shocked by my machine.
All for free.
Now, it's amazing that today, of course, you do that, you end up in Guantanamo Bay.
Yeah. Right. I mean, you go in a duffel bag with something pointing out the end, man, you're toast.
You know, in an earlier discussion with you, a question or an incident came up that I thought was interesting, and that was, I get asked all the time by students, science or med school? It was a choice that I had, a good choice, and for me, it was never med school, it was always science. And I know that you had some issues with that, and maybe you could discuss that a little bit.
Yeah, well, I'm from a medical family. My grandfather was a physician. My father was a physician. He married a nurse, and I was just never interested in medicine. I don't like being around sick people, and I definitely don't like the sight of blood. Particularly if it's mine, of course, but I'm an equal opportunity disdainer of blood. And so my older brother did go into medicine, and my sister went into nursing, but I never had any intentions of going that direction. And my parents never encouraged me to think about a career in medicine.
I mean, I always tell them, if you want to help people, and that's really your mind, be a doctor. But if you want to do something different every day, be a scientist. Mm.
Yeah.
I mean, the implication is there. If you don't want to help people, do science. And I think you phrased it the wrong way, but never mind.
Well, I wouldn't agree with that, Keith.
Anyway, you went on, therefore, to study what in school, when university? What, did you study physics straight from the beginning?
Well, university. We're talking about Caltech, I suppose. This is when Feynman was there. And
okay.
So I always thought that I would go into physics. And so I have to tell the story, though. Feynman, of course, was teaching all the freshmen and sophomores physics, and it was a two-year sequence. And I think because of that, about a third of my freshman class didn't return for their sophomore year. But of the two-thirds that remained, I think almost all of those guys wanted to go into physics. So Feynman was a wonderful filter of people who had a passion for physics. And so when you had to declare a major by the end of the first quarter of your sophomore year, and if you wanted to declare physics, you had to meet with a representative of the physics department, a guy named Robbie Vogt. And Robbie Vogt, by the way, is an interesting character. He was German, and he had been a member of the Hitler Youth Corps during World War II. I mean, obviously it wasn't his fault, but it was an interesting guy. So he looks around at, you know, I guess out of the 120 remaining students, I think there must have been at least 80 of us there. And he says, "You can't all go into physics." And what he should have said is, we can't possibly deal with a class this large. He said, "It's much too hard." He said, "If you're not near the top of your class," and I came in with a very bad math background, and Caltech, strangely enough, assumed that I knew differential calculus, which I didn't because it wasn't offered in my school. Anyway, so he says, "If you're not near the top of your class, forget it. And even if you are, be prepared to work miserably hard for the rest of your life." And then he confided that he had his best ideas at 2:30 in the morning. And it's kind of interesting because if you look back at my lab book and find out when I realized that I discovered superfluidity helium 3, it was 2:40 in the morning.
That's a good coincidence. Okay, so let's get on then to your days in graduate school, because it's not many Nobel laureates who did the work that they were recognized for as graduate students. I mean, this is not the norm. So tell us a little bit how you came to do those experiments.
Tell us what
superfluidity means.
Superfluidity. Well, first of all, it's superfluidity in general means that it's a fluid that has zero viscosity. Helium-4 was found to be a superfluid way back in, I think, in Moscow in 1937. And that actually won a Nobel Prize 43 years later. So you have to be patient if you're expecting a Nobel Prize. But anyway, so it is a state of matter where there's zero viscosity. But more than that, in fact, it's a macroscopic quantum state. And that's, I think, if you're a physicist, that's the interesting part about it, is you have all of these atoms which are acting in concert in some sense.
But I think for our listeners, perhaps you could define a little bit more your area of physics. What do you concentrate on?
Yeah, okay.
Not everything.
Yeah,
right.
And how did I get there, I suppose? Yeah, when I came to Cornell for graduate study, there were two lectures. One was a physics colloquium, one was a solid state seminar on new refrigeration technologies that were just being developed. One was something called the helium-3, helium-4 dilution refrigerator. This, I actually built one of these things my first year of graduate study. And this would allow you to cool matter to within about 15 thousandths of a degree of absolute zero.
At least. And one of the questions I had about that for our listeners, this is the lowest temperatures known, absolute zero. How do you actually measure it? How do you know what temperature you're at?
So you basically, what we typically do is look at the polarization of nuclei in a magnetic field. And it's essentially you're fitting it to a Boltzmann distribution of spins up and spins down, and it's a very accurate way of measuring the temperature.
Okay, so at absolute zero, what happens to all the spins in your...
Well, this reminds me of I was interviewed by someone that thought he knew something about science but didn't, and so he asked me, what happens at absolute zero? I think he said, "So, Dr. Ashraf, what happens at absolute zero?" And I said, "Well, it depends, but all of those systems get into the lowest energy state possible, and usually there's cooperative phenomena." He waved off the TV camera, which was actually, this was it being recorded at Bell Laboratories, and he says, "Just tell me that all motion ceases at absolute zero." And I said, "I can't do that because it's not true. There are several kinds of motion that are required by quantum mechanics, which is binding at all temperatures." And so we argued about this a little bit, and then eventually he agreed to do the interview straight, which is to say to accept my answer. And so then this thing aired on public television, And it started, he cut out almost everything that I was in this thing, except my name. My name was the thing that added authenticity to everything that he said. So it starts out, he looks right at the television camera and says, at absolute zero, all motion ceases.
So let's get on to then the moment of discovery. I mean, how did you come to set up the experiments? And it's nice to know you were there at 2:40 in the morning. Talk about this.
I was there a lot longer than that.
Right, yes.
It just happened that 2:40 was the time when. Yeah, so when I was at Caltech, I was working in an astrophysics group, and I thought I would go on in astrophysics. And in fact, I applied to graduate programs that were strong in astrophysics. I didn't apply to programs that were strong necessarily in condensed matter physics. And so then I think it was probably it was my senior year and about the time I had to make the decisions, I began to realize that I really wanted to do experiments. And I thought hard about it. I was actually at that time working in a group at Caltech that was studying the properties of superfluid helium-4. The experiments go on for maybe a short period of time, typically anywhere from a week to a month or something like that. They're not long term. It isn't that you have to wait years to get an answer. I said, this is exactly what I want to do. It's this whole business about tricking nature into giving up her secrets. That's what research is all about, at least for me. So that decision was made. And then when I got to Cornell, there were two lectures given on new refrigeration technologies that appeared to me to give one the opportunity of looking at nature in a new and very different realm, very close to absolute zero. So the first of those technologies was something called the helium-3, helium-4 dilution refrigerator. And as a first-year graduate student, I actually built one of those things. By the end of the summer, it was getting down to about 15 thousandths of a degree. So this was pretty exciting stuff. But the other technology gave you the promise of reaching temperatures below a thousandth of a degree above absolute zero. That had been a proposal by a Russian theorist named Isaac Pomeranchuk back in, I think it was 1950. He had made this proposal, and everyone thought that this couldn't possibly work. So no one tried it, and eventually a graduate student of Peter Pitz's, tried this and showed that, in fact, that it actually would cool. And then Dave Lee decided that he wanted to use this technique. And so he hired Bob Richardson. Bob Richardson was the professor, assistant professor at Cornell that then taught me everything I know about low-temperature physics, essentially.
We'll come back in a moment. This is Keith Pannell, Russ Chiannelli, and Professor Douglas Osheroff from Stanford University, and we'll be back in one moment.
Welcome to Medical Discovery News. I'm Dr. Norbert Herzog.
And I'm Dr. David Niesel. Do your sneezes come in pairs or threes? For some people, it's 10 in a row. Why is this?
Researchers have discovered it's because the sneezes are not powerful enough to do their intended job of ridding irritants in the nose. That's why people with disorders such as sinusitis are frequent sneezers.
We sneeze when a chemical or physical irritation enters and triggers the tissue lining our nose called the nasal mucosa. The signal is transmitted to the sneezing center in the brain. When enough nerves are stimulated, we sneeze.
The top speed for a sneeze is estimated at 950 feet per second, which is about 85% of the speed of sound. Quite remarkable, yet in people who sneeze a lot, their sneezes don't come anywhere near this, so they're unable to reboot the environment in their nose.
Researchers discovered this by studying cells from the noses of mice, how well the rodents cleared mucus and responded to simulated sneezes. They replicated and confirmed the same results in experiments with people who had sinusitis and those without.
Sinusitis is an inflammation of the nasal passages, and those with the disorder did not respond to sneezes the same way as healthy tissue.
But not all sneezes are to rid the nose of irritants. One disorder called photic sneeze reflex is uncontrollable sneezing when a person is exposed suddenly to brilliant sunlight. Also, adolescent girls can sneeze for months and are treated through therapy.
In some men and women, thoughts of sex or an orgasm can trigger sneezing, which could be embarrassing. So we're merely on the edge of discovering all the reasons behind sneezing. Amazing how something we all do can remain so mysterious.
We are Drs. David Neisel and Norbert Herzog at the University of Texas Medical Branch and the Frank H. Netter School of Medicine at Quinnipiac University, where biomedical discovery shaped the future of medicine. For much more and our disclaimer, go to medicaldiscoverynews.com.
Welcome back to Science Studio. Keith Pannell, Russ Chinelli, Douglas Osheroff from Stanford University. And we're talking about the sort of background to the key experiments on helium-3 that were performed way back in the 70s. Mm. And carry on with the story then. You've now got this piece of equipment that you've made, and you're going to start your experiments.
Yeah, so, well, it wasn't that fast. So the Pomeranchuk cell, I think I designed it my second year of graduate study. Ironically, a lot of the design work was done while I lay in the hospital bed recovering from knee surgery following a very serious skiing accident. So anyway, so the design was done, and I liked the design a lot. It was, I think, the best such device that I'd ever seen. And so then I submitted the drawings, and they came out, and then you, of course, have to assemble the apparatus. And so then the third year of graduate study, I was testing this thing to find out how well it worked, and it looked like it was going to get down to temperatures quite close to absolute zero. But there was another student that had an experiment that needed to go to lower temperatures than he could get. And so we collaborated the fourth year in doing his experiment. And this was actually testing an idea of a proposal or prediction by a English physicist named Tony Leggett. And it turned out in the end that Tony Leggett was the person that explained what it was that I discovered. But that was the first time I knew anything about Tony Leggett.
So then the actual experiment that you did, you exactly how did you discover that you'd made a big discovery? Did you understand at the time how important your result was?
Yeah. Well, it was still more complicated, okay? My thesis was supposed to be on nuclear spin ordering in solid helium-3. And no one had ever seen this phase transition, and it wasn't clear what the temperature was. In fact, people thought it was 2.5 millidegrees. It was actually 9/10,000ths of a degree. So it's harder to get to. And so I was doing some experiments that were giving me some information about the solid at higher temperatures. And the data was not very good. There's a lot of a scatter in the data due to my inability to measure the temperature very well. And eventually, two other students who had been waiting impatiently to use the lab's only iron core NMR magnet went to the Professor Lee and Richardson and suggested that I should be forced to give up this magnet. And they agreed. And for that, they shared the Nobel Prize with me because I wouldn't have done the experiment. It wasn't an experiment that was planned. So what happened? They took the magnet, and then I said, well, what can I do? I should keep this apparatus cold because maybe their experiment won't work. And then I would get the magnet back. And so I decided I would just do some very easy, curiosity-driven experiment. And when I did that, I was cooling down, looking at the melting pressure versus temperature. The pressure was rising, which meant it was getting colder. Then all of a sudden, there was a rather sharp kink in the curve, and it was cooling less rapidly. And I was, of course, very unhappy about that. Impossible to miss this thing, okay? And so I then said, well, okay, this is the day before Thanksgiving, 1971. So I will pre-cool the liquid to the lowest temperature I can obtain, which is 15 millidegrees with the helium-3, helium-4 dilution for sure, and try this again the next Monday. And so I did it the next Monday, and damn it, exactly the same sharp kink and decrease in the rate of cooling occurred.
So no experimental error.
I was very distraught with this. But then I noticed that the pressure had reproduced itself almost exactly pressure where that kink was. And that suggested to me this had to be the signature of some highly reproducible phase transition inside this mixture of liquid and solid helium-3. And even as I tell this story, the hair stands up on the back of my neck because I remember that ultimate exciting moment when I realized that I had really
discovered
seen
something
new. Yes. So ultimately, I had found not one but two unexplained phase transitions and really wasn't clear. The initial guess was that these transitions were in the solid helium-3. The solid had more entropy disorder, so it was ripe for ordering. But it was very difficult to separate out the properties of the liquid from the solid. I mean, you couldn't look inside the cell. It was buried deep inside several heat shields and things like that. And so I really didn't know what to do. And then there was this event where a squirrel was apparently walking along the high-tension, high-voltage power lines that brought electricity into Cornell University. And apparently it tried to jump off, but its tail was too long or something, and so it fried. And it knocked out the power at Cornell for about an hour. And when the power came back on, I found that one of my pumps had leaked air backward and formed a solid block in a pumping line inside my Dewar, which was at 4.2 Kelvin. So everything was solidified. So I had to warm up, and when I cooled back down, a leak had opened up in my apparatus. And that took a while to solve. So while that was happening, I started thinking about how I could differentiate what was going on in the liquid from what was going on in the solid. And I actually invented an early form of MRI, magnetic resonance imaging. Paul Lauterbur, actually, who was one of the people that shared the Nobel Prize for MRI, read my paper back in 1972. He was already doing his work, which was more sophisticated.
So this poor mouse, a rat, squirrel?
Squirrel.
Was part of the discovery.
He contributed to the discovery, I would say, contributed by giving his life for science.
But there was a moment when you realized this was a major discovery. 2 o'clock, 3 o'clock in the morning, who do you share it with? I mean, that's one of the key things that we've all done experiments of lesser quality, perhaps, but, you know, where you suddenly get a eureka moment and you got to tell somebody.
Yeah, it was the most, suddenly I looked at some old data. It was a few days old and something that I'd missed. The NMR signal from the liquid is very small compared to signal from the solid. So I kept looking at the solid. And then I looked and where one of these phase transitions occurred, we could see those in the pressure, there was a drop in the liquid magnetic susceptibility by a factor of 2. And I knew right away, and I wrote in my lab book, have discovered the BCS transition in liquid helium-3 tonight. You have to share this with someone. So, you know, there's at all hours of the day and night, there are people, graduate students, working in the basement of the physics building. This basement's where all the experiments get done. And so I ran around, and it turns out there was no one there except for me. So then out of desperation, I went up to the sixth floor to see if a graduate student had fallen asleep at his desk, a theory student. Turned out I was the only person there. And it was kind of interesting. I didn't for a moment think about calling my wife up. She was obviously asleep at this point anyway. But I called up my thesis advisor.
you had to be sure you were right.
I was pretty sure I was right though. As I called Dave Lee up, and he called me back 2 hours later, wanted more information. That was it. That was the Eureka moment.
So he stayed up thinking about it too, you think?
Don't think he got back to sleep at all. So that night I got zero sleep because, you know, I was working, and when I found it, there was no possibility I could get to sleep. The time that I heard from people in Stockholm, that was about 2:30 in the morning also, but different time zone because I moved to California in the meantime. And so this first minute of this phone call got recorded on our answering machine. And so I run around the bed to pick up the phone in the dark because my wife never picked up the phone. And so this guy says, hello, is this Douglas Osheroff? And I was really hacked off. I was sure it was a wrong number. He had asked for me by name, though. But I said, yes, and it's 2:30 in the morning. And this guy says, I know that, but I have a matter of some importance, if you would. I am Carl Ulf Jakobsen, Secretary General of the Royal Swedish Academy of Sciences. And he didn't have to say any more. I knew right away what this phone call was all about.
Do you ever wake up these days at 2:30 in the morning, wherever you are? Well, and wonder, what are you missing out on?
No. I wouldn't know what time zone I'm in. I do so much traveling now.
We'll come to that in a minute. Why helium-3? I mean, for those out there listening, helium is normally in the atomic number of 4. It's got 4 nuclei, 2 protons, 2 neutrons. What's special about helium-3? Where does it come from?
Helium-3, it's interesting. The natural abundance of helium-3 is extremely low. I think it would have been impossible for anyone to study properties of helium-3 were it not for the nuclear arms race. And in fact, there was specifically a guy at Los Alamos named Ed Hamill, who was responsible for keeping their tritium clean. And what that meant was the tritium decays with a half-life of 12.4 years into helium-3. So he kept separating out the helium-3, and he saved it, maybe partly because it was kind of radioactive, because it still had some tritium in it. But anyway, eventually he decides he's going to liquefy the helium-3 and measure the vapor pressure of helium-3 above the liquid as a function of temperature. And that basically set out a worldwide effort, because everyone knew helium-3 atoms are Fermi particles. They have a spin of one-half, like electrons in metals. And everyone knew, of course, that metals, some metals, these conduction electrons, would condense into a quantum macroscopic state, superconductivity. And so, in fact, I think it was 1959 was the first prediction that helium-3, if you could ever find, get enough sample and cool it far enough, would also condense into a BCS-ordered state. And that was the holy grail. But people all over the world looked for superfluidity helium-3, and there was a guy named, I mean, of course, theorists are very clever. Theorists will not predict that the transition temperature is something that's easy to get to. So they predicted, they will, so because that sucks you in. If they predict that it was 2 millidegrees, no one would ever try to do the experiment.
Right.
So they predicted, Phil Anderson anyway, predicted 80 millidegrees. And eventually people had gotten down to 2 millidegrees and hadn't seen anything. And so when I became a graduate student, the common wisdom amongst all the graduate students was that superfluidity in helium-3 was a pipe dream by the theorists.
You've done this key work. You've got this recognition. You've got your prize. You've got your $100,000 or whatever. How's your life changed? Are you still a scientist, or now are you a talker of science?
Yeah. Well, so the prize came in 1996. It was, and I'm actually very happy it didn't come earlier, because it really has an enormous impact on one's ability to actually do science after that. I go all around the world. I think I visited 40 different countries. I fly 150,000 miles a year, and I do sort of the kinds of things that I've done here at the University of Texas at El Paso. I give talks which I think are educational but stimulating to young people that will think about maybe going into careers in science rather than whatever they were thinking about. And I think it's something that's important. I feel it's important for me, or at least someone, to do this, because God knows we have lots and lots of challenges that are facing us, global warming and all of these things. And we need people who are committed to finding the answers to these problems and the technologies which will allow us to continue living on this earth in harmony with nature.
Anyway, Russell, do you want to say thank
yes,
you?
Yes, thank you very much to Douglas Osheroff. Please come back to Science Studio when you have a chance. And thanks to Norma Martinez, our producer.
Indeed. Thank you out there for listening. And Douglas, thank you so much for being here.
My great
pleasure.
And
we'll do another program next week just to sort of follow your career post-prize. Thank you for listening, everybody. And we'll be back next week with another Science Studio. Bye-bye.